It is a sphere some 6 feet in diameter made up of lenses, enclosing a space in the center of which is a ball of the phosphorescent store. During the day, the rays of the sun are concentrated upon this ball of stone, and at night, the stored, up sunlight, energy is radiated into light and heat. It was the close of a Martian day that we left the chorus hall. As we emerged, as I said before, upon the broad platform with its colonnade of columns and arches, we saw the city as the night drew on. Each house built of this strange substance, which during the day had been storing up the sun energy, now, as the fading day waned, became a center of light itself. At first, a glow covered the sides of the houses, the colonnade, and dome, while the glass prisms above them sent out rays from their seat of stored up energy. The glow spread, rising from the outskirts of the city in the lower grounds to the summits of the hills where the sun's last rays lingered. It became intensified. The green beds of trees were black squares and the houses, pulsating fabrics of light between them. The whole finally blended and a sea of radiance was before me in which the beautiful houses were described, the illuminated groves, and like enormous scintillations, the glassy spheres above them. As the night settled down, the light grew more intense, more beautiful. I could discern the opalescent glasses in the houses sending out their putty-colored rays, patching the trees with quilts of changing colors, and far away there came, still unsubdued by night, the continuous elation of music. So, we went down the steps into the city, and as we walked I asked Frank to tell me something of the Martian world. "The Martian world," said Frank, "is one country, very much like Venus. There are here no nationalities. The center of the country is in the city of Scandia, quite removed from the city of light. Business is carried on as with you on Earth, but its nature and its physical elements vary. As you will see, there is a circulating medium, banks and business enterprises. One prime element of difference is in the nourishment and the area of population. The Martian lives only on fruit, and he lives only a few degrees on either side of the equator. All the businesses that in your Earth arise from the preparation and sale of meat, and all the various confections disappear here, and also all the mechanism of house heating and lighting. There are no highways, no railroads, but many canals, which form a labyrinth of waterways, and are fed from the tides of the great northern and southern seas. The business is largely agricultural, but in the cities the pursuit of knowledge still continues. There is, however, on Mars a much lessened intellectual activity than on the Earth. It is a sphere of simplified needs and primal feelings exalted by acutely developed love of music. Mars is the music planet. We now approached the top of the broad hill on which the city is built, and came suddenly out into a square filled again in its park, like center with trees. From amid these trees rose a massive building, which I recognized as an observatory. The many round domes, as on Earth, were unmistakable. We entered the building and found that it was illuminated by its phosphory glass walls, and its cool broad halls and stairways were, in the soft light, very beautiful. But their wonderfulness consisted in the insertion upon the walls of illuminated plans and maps of the heavens. These miniature firmaments were all afire, so that each opening, carefully graded in size to represent stars of the first, second or third magnitude, was filled with a beaming point of light, and I walked in these noble corridors between reduced patterns of the universe of stars. We now reached the ascending stairway, which we walked up slowly, past great celestial spheres which filled the higher hallways. We entered a large central space, furnished with ivory chairs, and a broad massive center table, also of ivory, curiously inlaid with particles of the strange rock which gave out a liquid light and imparted indescribable beauty to the carved ornaments upon them. The floor was dark, a leaden color, lustrous, however, like black glass and made up in mosaic. Around the room were alcoves lit by lamps of the light rock, and in each alcove a glove of a blue metal upon which were painted sketches like charts or maps. A chandelier of this blue metal was pendant from the ceiling, and in its cup, like extremities, arranged in vertical tiers, were round balls of the light, rock glowing softly. Wide windows, unprotected by glass or sashes, just embrasures framed in white stone which everywhere prevails in Mars, looked out upon the marvelous city, which thus seemed a lake of glowing fires, over which rising and refluent waves of light constantly chased each other to its dark borders, where the surrounding plain country met the city's edges. The walls of this beautiful room rose to an arched ceiling which was inlaid with this wonderful blue metal, seen in the globes, designed in scrolls and waving ribbons, and just descending upon the walls, themselves in attenuated twigs and strings. The walls were bare and shining. How thrilled and awe-struck I became as I gazed around me, so many wonders on this planet and so little time to see it. We must move on. We left this wonderful building and made our way towards the Garden of the Fountains, which I was told lies over toward the great halls of philosophy, design and invention, whose domes and temple, pointed roofs of copper and blue metal I could easily discern it covers over half a square mile of space. It is supplied with water from an enormous lake resting in the hollow of an extinct volcano, 50 miles to the east of the City of Light, at an elevation of 5,000 feet. A great conduit or water pipe, as we would say, conveys the water to the garden. The garden is built actually upon piers of concrete and stone, connected by arches of brick, and through the subterranean chambers thus formed, the division of the streams is made, and they're controlled. The whole was designed by the great Martian artist, Hinode. The garden is approached through a labyrinthine avenue made up of palms, which on that side of the city seem to be plentiful, and over these palms, in extraordinary profusion, the vines of the red-flowered honeysuckle. You cannot see beyond the wall of green on either side in this winding way, and only as you gaze upward does the eye escape the imprisonment of its surroundings, where above the waving summits of the palms you see a lane of the bluest sky. As you draw near to the end of this oscillating road, into the garden, the splash and roar of falling waters invades your retreat. And then suddenly, as if a curtain had arisen or dropped to the ground, you emerge upon a great marble terrace of steps, and before you is spread a forest of geysers distributed in entrancing vistas in a lake of tumbling and scintillating waters. The scene is amazing and transporting. Rushing jets of water are enclosed in hollow pillars of glass, whose lines are ravishingly combined in the separate clusters of fountains. The heights of these fountains vary from 160 to 200 feet, and they are arranged in a peculiar disorder, which, however, conforms to an elaborate plan. The water rises in these colored tubes in green columns, then breaks into sheets and bubble, laden cataracts of spray above them, pouring far outward like blazing showers of little lamps in the full sunlight. Many of the tubes are inclined, and the ejected shafts of water collide above them, producing explosive clouds of shattered vesicles of moisture that float off or drop in miniature rains over the lake. It made a bewildering picture. The exposure of water in the great lake which holds these fountains is broken with waves and the tempestuous scene with the constant excitement of the rising and flowing avalanches of water creates feelings of abounding wonder. The marble steps extend around the lake, and behind them on all sides rises the wall of the palms, beaten into motion by the wind blowing ceaselessly. Frank decided it was time for us to get back to the X-12. We bid good bye to the six who had first met us, and also to a great number of others as we walked the beautiful streets in this wonderful city of light. Back on board the X-12. On our long trip back to Earth, the question in my mind was the gold rocks which the Martians said we could have. I was wondering, would we be coming back to Mars soon? And in what manner Frank would place that heavy gold in the X-12? To my question, Frank said, "Think well about this large amount of gold. Will having all that in your possession keep you happy and in good health? Do you know anyone on Earth who has millions of dollars who is truly happy, healthy and well? Consider it well, my friend. The gold is yours if you wish to have it, but in my opinion, nothing can replace your present well-being, your good health, and the joy you share with others. Therefore, I want you to think the matter over until we arrive near to Earth. Then, and only then, give me your answer." Frank then left me to my thoughts while he went about the great ship. It required deep thought. Few, if any, Earthmen had seen even 1/1000th part of the amount of gold in that big rock. As the owner of it, I would be the richest man on Earth. Did I really wish to be that rich? I will not trouble you with all my thoughts, except to say that I came to the conclusion not to have the gold. When we came within a few miles of the Earth, Frank and Francis came to talk with me. "Well," asked Frank, "have you made up your mind? Do you, or do you not, want that gold?" In reply, I found it hard at first, but managed to say, "No, Frank, I do not want that gold, but I would like you to tell me how you expected to bring it to Earth." If I had said yes, Frank said, "Good thinking, Arthur. We are very pleased to hear you say that you do not want the gold. As for the means by which we can bring the gold to Earth, if you desire, I will show you. As it is still daylight, we will remain at this level, and during our wait, which will be several hours, we might just as well set up our machine, by which we can transport the gold of Mars right onto your property." Frank grinned at me as we walked into the workshop, or the second level of the X-12. "In this manner I will show you that which I intended to do. If it was your wish to have all that gold, however, we are more than pleased to know that you do not want it, but we shall, if you like, transport just a little of that gold, to prove to you that we could, if it was your desire, place all of it right in your field." Frank gathered together an assortment of things, tools and materials, electrical parts, wire, condensers, etc., and with all these things, I helped Frank to build a machine, a queer-looking thing, which I thought was a very large high-frequency generator, until Frank enlightened me to what it really was. "This," said Frank, "is the Tesla method of developing a microwave of great power. Thousands of electrical horse power is by this means built into a tiny beam, of less than 1 degree in diameter. By the power which we have on the X-12, we shall operate this machine, when we land on your property. The tiny wave, or ray, developed will be directed exactly to hit the desired rock of gold. This gold rock, now located on the planet Mars, will be our positive pole. Then by means of this Tesla device the power ray, or beam, will be reflected from the gold rock, that is the positive atoms, and directed towards this negative pole. The gold is now broken up into its microscopic elements and becomes united with the elements of the micro wave and thus carried to the negative pole by means of the reflective elements of the power ray. The Tesla device is therefore a practical method of transmutation of solids, that is the extracting ore or metal from a distant body without intervening physical means." By the time we had completed the machine, it was late evening. The X-12 completed the trip, and we landed around 10 p.m. We set up the machine in our field, beside the X. Frank applied the power and directed the ray so that it would hit the gold rock on Mars. Then, driven by accurate clockwork, the wave could be depended upon to retain the proper direction, when once set. The ray was thus aimed directly, as I have said, at the large rock of pure gold. With breathless interest, I watched the proceedings of Frank. The strain upon my poor nerves was such as could not have been borne for many hours at a stretch. When everything had been adjusted to his satisfaction, Frank stepped back, and pressed a lever. The powerful atomic engine, which he had built a few hours ago, instantly responded. "The beam is set exactly in the center of the large gold rock," said Frank. Then we waited. A minute elapsed, 2 minutes. I could hear the beating of my heart. The engine shook the ground. 3 minutes. 4 minutes. We were like statues with eyes fixed on the polished ball of silver, supported by means of a high metal frame work, which had a polished rod curved over the top like a crane. This was in fact the pole from which the energy was transmitted to the golden rock on Mars. 5 minutes. At last, I shouted, "Look, look!" The shining ball had become a confused blue in color, and I violently winked to clear my eyes. At last, the silver knob again changed color, What seemed like a miniature rainbow surrounded it with concentric circles of blinding brilliance. Then something dropped, flashing into a dish set beneath the ball. Another, and another, glittering drop followed, and another. Almost before a word could be spoken, the drops had coalesced and become a tiny stream, which as it fell, twisted itself into a bright spiral, gleaming with many shifting hues, then overflowing from the dish. The tiny stream gradually grew in size, faster and yet faster it flowed, an interlacing maze of rings. After the 5 minute start, we timed the flow at 1 ounce per minute. Frank said this could be speeded up to a much greater amount. Frank let the machine operate for another minute, then turned off the power and we placed the parts of this wonderful machine into the X equals 12. Frank and Francis bid me good bye with the promise of returning soon. Chapter 10. It was some weeks after the last visit of the great Venus space ship, and my first journey to the planet Mars that I heard from my Venus friends. Then one night the alarm on the Tesla scope sounded. It was Frank with another suggestion, this time, an invitation to take a further journey to Mars, but not in person. Frank said Francis would transport me to Mars by means of mental projector. I agreed. I would indeed like to complete our journey, for I felt sure there must be many more interesting things to see. So it was arranged. They would again visit me, sometime in Mardi. It was during the early morning of March 14, 1969 that the alarm again sounded. I did not waste any time getting to the X-12. They were all ready for me. Frank and Francis were at the open door, with bright smiles to greet me. Good morning, Arthur. Come right in. Francis had her projector all set up. Let's go, said Frank. Take a seat, Arthur. I did so, and the next thing I knew, I was on the planet Mars, walking along with Frank. How wonderfully strange and exciting it all seemed. We walked to the large canal, hurried to the pier, and got into a small boat. It was a curious vessel which appeared to be made of white porcelain, broad and short, with raised keel, prow, and expanded stern, moved by some form of electric motor. A pilot took his place at the bow, and, under a canopy of silk, in the light of a setting sun, followed by the music of the City of Light, we passed the city, which even as we left it, slowly, in the descending darkness of the night, began to brighten with the light of the rock, and send upward its magic glow. These boats, said Frank, are not in common use on the canals. The larger boats, which are used for transport, are made of the blue metal. All the boats are propelled by explosive engines, except these small ones, which have an electric motor. The power used to generate the electric current is obtained from the energy rock. These porcelain boats are curious. Their sides, prows, poop and stern are ornamented by colored designs, which are burnt in when the boat is made, for these extraordinary boats are made in huge furnaces in one piece, like a jug, vase or bowl. This small boat is propelled by a screw of blue metal. Down the crowded canal we slowly moved, amidst the calling crews, the pleasant cheers, and beckoning of sight, seers, and back of us rose on its hills the City of Light, which as we passed still further away, and watched in the fading sunset, began to glow, and finally, to shine like some titanic opal in the velvet shadows of the night. Chapter 10 Part 2. As we slowly moved into the undulating plain country, with its pretty towns and farmlands, it reminded me of our beautiful eastern townships in the province of beautiful Quebec. We saw solitary projections of rock as the stars stole urgently into the sky. The magic stone lamps began their soft illumination of the decks, while the sound of songs from people on the land came to us in snatches bewitchingly mixed with the strange odors of the beautiful flowers and grass, which grew along the sides of the canal. The landscape about us was wonderfully illuminated by the two satellites, Deimos and Phobos, which as is well known, were first seen, or perhaps I should say, were reported to have been seen, by astronomers on Earth. Professor Asaph Hall is said to have been the first one on Earth to report them, in 1977. What a marvelous sight they presented, moving almost sensibly at their differing rates of revolution through a sky sown with stellar lights. The combined lights of these singular bodies surpassed the light of our Earth moon, by reason of their closeness to the surface of Mars, while the more rapid motion of the inner satellite causes the most weird and beautiful changes of effect in the nocturnal glory they both lend to the Martian life. We were now sailing in a wide river, like canal, about a mile or more wide. On all sides the undulating ground, covered with cultivation, varied with thick patches of trees, with here and there shining lights from towns and isolated homes, carried the eye onward to a rising hill country, beyond which, again, silhouetted against the shining sky where Phobos began to rise, mountain tops were just discernible. Deimos, the outer moon, was already shining, and its pale, sick light imparted a peculiar blueness, impossible to describe, upon A11 surfaces it touched. Here was the phenomenon we witnessed with increasing pleasure. Phobos was emerging from a cloud and its yellow rays possessing a greater illuminating power, mingled suddenly with the blue beams of Deimos, and the land thus lit by the combined flood of light from these twin lights seemed suddenly dipped in silver. A beautiful white light, most unreal, fell on tree and water, cliff, hill, and towns. It was a print in silver, and while we gazed in mute astonishment, the sharp shadows changed their position as Phobos, racing through the zenith, changed the inclination of its incident beams. The effect was indescribable. I walked the deck in an agitation of wonder and delight, a delicious drowsiness overcame me, and after a while I noticed the pilot was changed, his place being taken by another, and that we were approaching a ridgy or rocky country. I found my way to the white couch prepared for me, and sank into a deep and dreamless sleep. Part 2, Chapter 10. The morning of the next day was clear and beautiful. Shall I ever forget that first approach to the mountains of Tainitai, where Tur and Nir, the villages of the quarries, are located? All day long the boat ran through a diversified country, covered with great hills of worn pebbles and rolling plains of what appeared to be sand. The canal passed through solitudes, where the silence was only broken by the cackling laugh of a crane, like bird, marching in lines along the banks, or perched like sleepy sentinels amid the outstretched branches of the trees. These wild and fascinating regions were often alternated by miles of bright plantations, radiant with the yellow leaves of the taloif, bearing its deep red pods, while avenues of palms, not unlike the royal palm of the earth, led in long vistas to clustering groups of houses, and we also caught glimpses of little lakes. I was interested in the Martian custom of public worship. Frank pointed out to me the churches of the people. They appear to be built of the magic stone, high above the ground, and approached by encircling terraces of steps. Frank said he did not understand the Martian faith. There seemed, he said, little to understand about it. It was one national expression of the love of goodness and of beauty, but it was all directed to a source of infallible wisdom, power and justice. At last, we arrived at the entrance of a gloomy and stupendous gorge. It was the wonderful passage driven through the first area of igneous rocks before we reached the quarry country of the Tainitai. It pierced the dark and stubborn dike that rose in sheer walls 1,200 feet above our heads, and it seemed that the tide was carrying us into the bowels of the sphere. At that moment a loud report was heard, followed by another. Looking upward, Frank with outstretched hand said, "It was a meteor, a big one." He called to the pilot to stop the boat. A few of the attendants were grouped near us, and the loudly suppressed exclamations made me realize that these visitations were perhaps infrequent upon Mars. It was a meteoric shower, like our Leonids in November, which I had seen many times at Lakeport. It rained pellets, or balls of fire, these phosphorescent trains gleaming spectrally, while a kind of half-audible crackling accompanied the fall, shooting in irregular shoals or volleys. They would increase and diminish, and recurrent explosions announced the arrival at the ground of some meteoric mass. We continued on our way, and soon entered a wild, savage, almost treeless country, the bare grey or rusty and jagged expanses sloping up steeply from the edge of the canal, sparingly dotted over with grey bushes, and covered with an ashen-coloured lichen. We moved for miles through the waste of Chapter 10, Part 2. A ruined world. The whole region had been the stage of great volcanic activity, and the broad plains excavated with deep pools that reflected their dismal, untenanted borders in the black depths of unruffled water, spoke of meteorological conditions long prolonged and intense. It was a weird, strange place, silent and dead. But, amongst these vast ejections, these fossil craters were embedded masses of the rare self, luminous magic stone that made the City of Light. The canal passed along for miles in a depression between two folds of the surface. Finally, gazing ahead, there slowly came into view a huge, gaping rent in the side of the black and grey and red walls to our right, and a minute movement of living forms, scarcely discernible, revealed the first quarry near the little town of Tours. As we drew nearer, I descried a slanting climb from the open excavation down which the blocks of stone were slid. They were brought to the surface by hoisting cranes, and just as our little boat glided to the dock, an enormous piece of stone was moving down the metal roadbed to the edge of the canal. Here we landed, and a crowd of people hailed us, and amongst them were many of the copper-colored northerners who work in the quarries. Their day's work was over, and they crowded around us with interest. They were good, natured, but quiet, and dressed in a kind of overalls that was made in one garment from head to feet. Frank pushed amongst them, followed by me. We made our way to a pleasant house, built of the magic rock, and covered with an almost flat roof of the blue metal. In this house we were received by the superintendent of quarries. The greetings were pleasant, and as the superintendent spoke both French and English, we got along fine. One, the rooms of this house were large square apartments, simply furnished with the white chairs, tables and couches I had seen in the City of Light, but on its walls were drawings of the quarry, the country, and groups of the workmen. Amongst the pictures were some wonderful large scenes of a nice country, and the lustrous high wall of a gigantic glacier. I pointed these out to Frank. He told me that to the north of the mountains lay the Great Northern Sea, in winter a sea of ice, and that from continental elevations within it, glacial masses pushed outward, invading the southern country. In regions beyond there were fertile plains. Here were their settlements from which the workmen of the quarries had been brought. Beyond this again lay the margins of the polar sea. Song and music closed the day, and after eating the wine, soaked cakes, which the superintendent offered us, we made our way to the white and simple bed chamber. The morning came, fresh and splendid. The air of Mars is so pure, vivid and dustless. We walked to the quarry mouth, Frank and the superintendent in front of me, leading the way. I stood looking backward every few steps, delighted to trace the broad river of the canal winding through the desolation for miles beyond. Then I noticed how rapid and effortless is motion in Mars. Volition is so easy and penetrating, the body becomes a mere plaything for the mind. Frank beckoned to me, and as I looked where he was pointing, I saw just ahead, a great black object, about which a number of workmen were running excitedly like a swarm of ants. Frank said, "You remember the meteor we saw last night? Well, there it is." Extended like a gigantic and deformed missile lay an iron meteorite, still warm. A crevice spread down into its interior, and it bore the pits and depressions of the terrestrial objects. It measured some 4 feet in length, and must have weighed many tons. We continued our walk and soon stood gazing upon the receding roof of the great cavern, the heavy walls left like buttresses to hold up the overlying mountain ridge. The quarry extends far in under the ridge. We were to descend, but before we did so the superintendent led us to the sunlit of the ridge. From here, we looked at a distant land beyond the volcanic area, occupied by farms and villages. It seemed peaceful and attractive. Beyond this, again, we just discerned the shimmering surface of the great glacier, the superb train of ice. We descended again to the mouth of the quarry, and here we mounted a platform, used for an aerial elevator. On this we were swung far out from the dizzy sides of the quarry, slowly SLC through the shaft of air, then passed into the cooler shadows of the deeper parts, where the sun failed to penetrate.